for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. The Supreme Court yesterday overturned decades of campaign finance regulations, allowing corporations and labor unions to spend freely on behalf of candidates. Republican Scott Brown's victory in the Massachusetts special election threw health care legislation up in the air, and the president called on Congress to restrict the size and scope of the nation's largest financial institutions. Joining me in the studio for this hour, the domestic hour of the Friday News Roundup, Jackie Combs of the New York Times, Naftali Ben-David of the Wall Street Journal, and Susan Milligan of the Boston Globe. Throughout the hour, I'll look forward to hearing from you. 800-433-8850. Send us a tweet or join us on Facebook, as many already have, or join us through email to drshow@wamu.org. It's been quite a week of news. Good morning, everybody.
Good morning.
Naftali, talk about this Supreme Court ruling. What precisely does it mean?
Well, what this ruling said is that it's not constitutional for the government to restrict the money that corporations spend for or against individual candidates. They still can't give money to the candidates, but now they'll be allowed to spend money advocating defeating or the victory of a particular candidate. And this does upend a very long series of precedents. And it was really sort of an aggressive move by the court because the court was not really asked to decide this on broad grounds. This had to do with a movie about Hillary Clinton, and it could have been decided very narrowly. But instead, they asked for this case to be re-argued, which is very unusual. And they were clearly looking to overturn this particular law.
So, Jackie Combs, the effects on this year's elections.
Well, there'll be a lot more money from corporate America flowing into the congressional races, which, you know, typically benefits Republicans, who were already on the upside this year anyway, since Democrats are on the defensive. They're the party in total power. At the same time, you know, corporations look at the landscape, and they see that Barack Obama is going to be in power for at least three more years. And so that will have a sort of moderating effect on just how, you know, pro-Republican any corporation wants to get. That said, it was really an extraordinary opinion. It's going to be one of those opinions that we read about, that our future generations read about in textbooks and actually know the name of, I think, you know, like Plessy versus Ferguson and something like that. And the silver lining is we won't see those issue ads anymore, that just sort of you couldn't tell who was putting them on the air. A corporation would be backing an issue ad, and it was really a negative one for a particular candidate, but it got around the limits on corporations actually buying ads against a candidate. And so now there'll be a little more clear who's behind an ad, so that could work against a candidate who's seen as, say, the candidate of Wall Street.
Susan Milligan, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
What happens now to the whole issue of campaign finance reform? Is it truly gone, or will Congress take more action?
I think Congress wants to take more action. I just think that with everything else they've got on their plate right now, with trying to salvage health care, doing something about the job situation, even immigration, I just don't see it coming up anytime soon. But I do think it's going to be interesting to see how this plays out, because businesses tend to contribute to the party in power. So while certainly a lot of corporations, a lot of financial services corporations don't necessarily like the Democrats, they've gotten the bulk of contributions during this election cycle, and it's up substantially from the last election cycle, the more power they get. And some corporations might, it's a little dicier when you're running an ad that kind of, you know, advocates for or against a candidate, and some of them might not want to take on a particular member. And it'll be interesting, too, to see whether the shareholders get involved in this at all, the way some shareholders have been trying to have a greater say in executive pay and so forth. It'll be interesting to see whether they push back on this if a board wants to do something.
Why did the Supreme Court choose to do this at this time, Naftali, when you said earlier They didn't really have to take this on this way.
Well, I think this goes to the broader question of the character of the Roberts Court. You know, when Chief Justice Roberts appeared before Congress for his confirmation hearings, he made a big deal about modesty and about respecting precedent. But critics of the court say that they haven't been particularly respectful of precedent, and they actually have something of an agenda of overturning precedents that they feel were wrongly decided. And if you read this decision, they go out of their way to justify their decision to overturn precedent. They say that the precedent was poorly reasoned. They say that it hasn't worked out well. But by those standards, you could overturn any precedent because people always think that precedents were poorly reasoned if they don't like them. So I think what they're doing is they're increasingly establishing a little bit of a track record as a court that's willing to take on and overturn issues if they disagree with them.
Which is really extraordinary when you think about it, that for a generation now, it's been the right and the conservatives who have argued against a judicial activism and a court that, you know, legislates by judicial ruling. And there's no better example in recent times of a judicial activism than this decision.
And so who is it likely to benefit more?
Republicans.
You know, you could tell by the reactions of everybody yesterday. Everybody cited principle and lofty ideas, but the Republicans cheered the decision. The Democrats strongly attacked it. And you could just tell that everybody's looking at November and wondering how it's going to affect them.
Naftali Ben-David of the Wall Street Journal, Jackie Combs of the New York Times, Susan Milligan of the Boston Globe. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Susan Milligan, that election in Massachusetts stunned an awful lot of people. A fellow who in December had hardly been known. How'd he do it?
Well, he fought for it and he earned it. And as most Democrats in Massachusetts will tell you, Martha Coakley, the Democrat, wasn't really out there that much. Well, granted, she was 30 points ahead in early December, probably thought that she didn't really have to get out there and campaign for it. And Brown was out there really appealing to sort of people's anger about Wall Street, to some degree about health care, although I don't think that was remotely the defining issue in that campaign, and just their generalized anger over the way things are going. She really ran a startlingly sort of passionless campaign, and at one point said, well, what am I supposed to do, stand outside Fenway Park in the cold and shake hands? Ted Kennedy would have done that.
What do you think, Naftali? What is this loss truly going to mean to Democrats?
Well, it's on two levels. I mean, on the one hand, there's an immediate effect in that health care reform is clearly going to be much, much harder to pass if it can be done at all. So that's kind of the immediate outcome because the Democrats no longer have the 60-vote margin in the Senate. But there's this sort of larger issue, which is that you sense something of a momentum shift. And just on Capitol Hill this week, the Democrats seemed much more like they were playing defense where they had been playing offense. So I think that it's really sent certain shockwaves through the Democrats, and you hear them talking a lot more about needing to listen to the voters, needing to respect their will. And I think we're going to see the rest of the year play out with this election in mind in both parties.
Jackie, it would seem that during the election campaign of Barack Obama, he was certainly in touch with the people. Has his performance affected what happened in Massachusetts?
Well, I think it certainly did. And, you know, the sense that, you know, sort of ironically, Scott Brown, the Republican in Massachusetts, did seize on public anger, especially on the right and among independents, with the financial bailout of Wall Street, which, as a matter of fact, has worked, as shown by the fact that they've come back from the abyss. And people forget our financial system was on the abyss. They're making big profits and paying big bonuses. And that makes people mad when you have 10% unemployment, nearly 20% when you count people who are underemployed. So, but on the other hand, Scott Brown was against the bank tax that President Obama wants to impose on the biggest banks, so to make up for any losses in the bailout. And it's just, I think there's going to be going forward, there's going to be two big issues for the Democrats, jobs and anti-Wall Street.
anti-Wall Street, Neftali?
Yeah, absolutely. You've already seen a shift in the rhetoric. It's really extraordinary. It starts at the top, and you've seen President Obama talk very fiercely this week about banks being reckless, and he's proposing all kinds of new regulations and taxes on the bank. There's a whole populist tone. But you see it on Capitol Hill, too. There was a press conference the other day where Harry Reid was asked about health care. And for the first time, I saw him answer it by saying, well, health care is just part of a much bigger issue. This has to do with jobs and the economy, and people are hurting. And he talked about that for several minutes before getting back to health care. I think that's the rhetoric you're going to be seeing, much more populist, much more anti-Wall Street, and much more trying to be in touch with people and their concerns about their jobs and their homes.
And, of course, Nancy Pelosi yesterday came out and said she did not have the votes in the House to pass the Senate health care bill, Susan.
Well, that's true. And the Senate bill is, of course, more conservative, for want of a better word, than the House bill. And a lot of the House liberals are angry enough that even their bill didn't have, you know, or that the Senate bill doesn't have a public option. And that's part of the problem she's having. The Democratic Party in general and the president in general are having a big problem with the progressive wing of the party and with the young voters who were so whipped up in 2008. And they don't oppose him at this point, but they're a little frustrated that their agenda isn't moving along as quickly as they thought it would.
And why is that? It would seem that President Bush got a fair amount done without having 60 votes in the Senate. Why is it that this is so important?
Well, it's a lot easier to pass a tax cut than it is to reform, right, you know, 17% of the economy by doing a health care bill.
And a Medicare prescription and drug bill, right, that was not offset by savings of other kinds.
Exactly, exactly. But, I mean, the thing about health care, and we saw this in the 92 campaign as well, is that people are very unhappy with the situation with health care, with the costs and so forth, but they get nervous when you talk about changing it.
Susan Milligan, national political reporter for the Boston Globe. Jackie Combs is with the New York Times. Neftali Ben-David is with the Wall Street Journal. Short break, right back. And we're back with the domestic portion of our Friday News Roundup this week with Susan Milligan of the Boston Globe, Jackie Combs, and New York Times, Neftali Ben-David of the Wall Street Journal. We do invite you to join us, call us, send us an email, give us a tweet, or join us on Facebook. Here's an email from Paula in Ohio. I take that back. Yes, it is an email. The Democrats still need to find their focus. The president needs to have economic results to show. The administration needs to prevent more foreclosures. I really hope the Democrats exercise a little patience and careful thought before acting and don't abandon health insurance reform. Now, is health insurance reform what may be left of health reform? Neftali.
Well, that's certainly the, you know, when they talk about maybe just passing some of the more popular elements, that's in large part what they're talking about.
What does that mean?
Well, it means things like preventing insurers from declining coverage based on pre-existing conditions, lifetime caps, requiring insurance companies to cover dependents up to a higher age, things like that, the things that a lot of people hate about insurance companies.
Do they have the support to do that?
I think they do, but I think that there's a complexity there because it's very hard to make those reforms without expanding the pool of people who are insured. And that part, the individual mandate, is unpopular. So this bill was fairly carefully constructed so that one part of it is dependent on another. And so just plucking out the popular parts and passing them, while it's something that has a great deal of appeal, might be harder than it sounds.
Jackie.
You know, it's interesting that the individual mandate is now so unpopular and that Republicans are nearly united in opposing it, because when some of us were covering the health care reform effort in 1994, when Bill Clinton tried and failed, he proposed a mandate on employers, that employers had to provide health insurance to employees. Republicans' comeback at the time, their alternative plan, was that no, employers shouldn't have a mandate, but individuals should have a mandate and take responsibility to have health insurance. And so it's sort of striking to me now that the Republican Party has come to a place where, and even in the last year, it's been, only been in the last year, that Chuck Grassley, the chief Republican on the Senate Finance Committee with a primary jurisdiction on this issue, has completely switched positions on this. And from promoting, he compared having health insurance, promoting an individual mandate for health insurance as akin to having a driver's license or motor insurance, and now he's opposed to it.
And yesterday we saw Wall Street plummet more than 200 points as the president talked about financial reform of the banks. Of course, the whole administration is trying to shift this focus. But what would these new financial rules mean for the banks?
Well, there are two main ones. One is that they would try to prevent them from getting too big. There are certain limitations on market share for certain liabilities that they would have. And the other thing is that it would try to prevent what's seen as risky investment behavior, proprietary trading and things like that. So President Obama came out and spoke very firmly in that regard. One of the interesting elements of that one is I think he's happy to propose these things and perhaps have the Republicans be on the other side of them. I mean, he talked about this being a fight he would welcome. And indeed, you saw some Republicans yesterday talking about how these reforms would interfere with the operation of the free market. But I think that is a fight that he wants to have. So either he gets these regulations, or if he doesn't, he at least has an issue where he puts the Republicans on the side of the banks and the Democrats on the side of the people.
Susan.
I agree. I mean, that I think that the president's been far more populist recently in his tone on this sort of thing. And if there's one issue that seems to really resonate with people, particularly with independents, is this issue of the banks kind of getting away with everything. And, you know, for a free market, they certainly didn't mind taking government bailout money. And people are pretty angry at what they see as people being rewarded, never mind not punished for what happened. So I think that'll work very much for the Democrats.
What can the president and the administration do at this point about jobs?
Well, that's interesting because very few people expect the unemployment rate to come down this year, because even as the economy improves and more people are hired, there may be by next month positive numbers in terms of more jobs being created than lost. But at the same time, you have the better things start to look. People who had given up looking for a job are going to come back into the workforce, which will keep the unemployment rate high. And you constantly have a new influx of would-be workers coming out of colleges and high schools all over the country, adding to the roll. So the actual unemployment rate, which is what people, voters, focus on, will continue to be high. The House, right before Christmas, passed a jobs bill of about $150 billion of tax cuts for small business and other incentives and infrastructure spending, and it was expected that that would come through the Senate pretty quickly. I think a lot of that is in flux right now. It was not looking as easy as people thought even before Massachusetts, and now the Massachusetts Senate race complicates things because it underscores that squeeze that the Obama administration and Democrats are in, which is the public is angry. They're saying, you're not doing enough for me. It's all for the big banks. And on the other hand, they're saying, but you're spending too much.
And the other question is how soon they're likely to seat that Massachusetts senator. Naftali?
Well, I mean, I think they're going to seat him relatively soon. I mean, everybody from President Obama to Harry Reid to Henry Waxman has been saying, look, let's not play games here. Let's not try to delay him being seated and rush anything through. In fact, I think the opposite. I think they're trying to make a point of showing that they respect Scott Brown, that they respect the will of the voters. President Obama has talked to him by phone. Harry Reid has welcomed him to the Senate. I think they're very careful about how this would look if they seem to be thumbing their noses at Brown and by extension, at the voters.
What about the question of jobs and how much more the administration can or will do at this point, Susan?
Well, I think they have to be very careful about appearing to be overspending, if they're talking about a second sort of stimulus or spending more government money, because believe it or not, the debt and the deficit are back as issues. It's like Ross Perot all over again. I mean, that's actually starting to resonate with people and not just conservatives. So they need to be concerned about that as well.
Naftali.
I mean, the Senate is talking about doing a jobs bill that would include some infrastructure spending, some aid to state and local government, that sort of thing. But I agree with Susan and Jackie that the Democrats have two big imperatives this year, deficit reduction and job creation. And to a very real degree, they're at odds.
Jackie. And on deficit reduction, we should say no one is really going to be proposing that they cut spending much or raise taxes much beyond what they'd like to do on this charging big banks and getting about $9 billion a year. Because the economy is still fragile, we're still in danger, many economists will tell you, of a double-dip recession. And to either cut spending or raise taxes this year would risk throwing the economy back into recession. That said, what they're going to try to do in the president's budget in early February and what he will try to spell out in his State of the Union address on January 27th, right, is to lay out a long-term path so that the main savings and revenue increases they will propose will be out years beyond 2010, fiscal 2011.
It's interesting to see the disappointment expressed by even many of President Obama's supporters. That piece that Paul Krugman wrote surprised me, saying, I have to admit, I am disappointed in this man, Jackie.
It is, and it's, but it's also interesting that people like Paul Krugman, who have been criticizing the president all along, particularly for the health care bill because it wasn't measuring up to be as expansive as he wanted, are now calling on the House Democrats to pass the Senate bill that Mr. Krugman has long, and the rest of liberal pundits have long opposed. So, you know, it's almost like you want to suggest they take a little of the blame themselves.
Susan.
You know, it's interesting because I've been thinking a lot about Senator Kennedy during this health care debate. And he and I had a conversation a few years ago where he told me that one of his biggest regrets is that they didn't do health care when they had the chance under Nixon. It was pay or play. They didn't want to do it. He said, in retrospect, we should have gotten the structure in place. We could have just improved on the details later on. But you have so few opportunities as legislators to get the momentum going, to get fundamental changes made. He went through that with the Medicare prescription drug bill, though he ended up trying to filibuster that bill. But he was trying to convince his caucus, which didn't like the benefit, didn't like the donut hole, that just get the structure in place. We can always fix the details later on. And I don't know exactly how he'd come down on this bill, but I suspect he'd be saying something of the same thing.
Naftali.
Well, I mean, back to your point about the liberals and how they feel about President Obama. I mean, President Obama did an unbelievable job during the campaign of appealing to a wide range of different kinds of people. But for progressives, they saw this as the second coming of Franklin Roosevelt. In fact, Time or Newsweek, I don't remember which it was, put Obama on the cover as Franklin Roosevelt. And people in this Congress were talking about this being like the Congress of 1933, and there was going to be a new deal. That's the level that the hopes were at for liberals just a year ago, that this would be a great wave of progressive legislation. Obviously, it hasn't turned out that way, and I think there is some real disappointment.
You know what stunned me the most? I looked at the cover of Foreign Policy magazine yesterday and saw President Obama equals President Carter. I thought that was a bit premature. Jackie?
That was a fairly stunning cover, although there was a part of me that thought, well, you know, if you could get a big step toward peace in the Middle East, as President Carter did, that wouldn't be the worst sort of outcome of your foreign policy. But that wasn't the point of the article, of course. It was about the sort of you know, lack of clarity abroad and the failure to sort of get the rest of the international community on your side. But it is premature, I think.
Back to the financial questions, does what has happened in Massachusetts and with health care and the banks and the bailouts and the bonuses make prospects for Bernanke even less clear? Naftali.
I think it probably does. You've actually seen in the last couple of days a lot of more people speaking out against him on both ends of the political spectrum. I mean, my sense is that, you know, he'll be confirmed ultimately, that it's not really going to be a challenge. But there's no question that there's a great deal of unrest about these issues, and that's affecting everything. And it's affecting people, interestingly, on both ends of the political spectrum.
And what about the Treasury Secretary? Any thoughts about the job he's doing, Jackie?
Well, I think he... he's sort of the lightning rod for this administration, and you continue to hear speculation occasionally, and it's spiked up now because of this week's announcement of this yesterday's announcement by the president of these limits on big bank size and scope of their risk-taking activities. This was a sort of idea that originated with Paul Volcker, the former Fed chairman, who has been an outside advisor, a truly outside advisor, because he hasn't been really included in the deliberation. So the fact that this Volcker plan, as the president characterized it, it seemed to denote a shift away from Tim Geithner, the Treasury Secretary's more cautious and, a cautious policy towards the financial system. That said, I find no evidence within the West Wing that Mr. Geithner's job is in danger. I think, in fact, privately the president has felt like he and the secretary have not gotten the credit they deserve for having brought the financial system back from the abyss.
Jackie Combs at the New York Times, and you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Let's open the phones, 800-433-8850. First to Dallas, Texas. Good morning, Autumn. You're on the air.
Yes, ma'am. I just want to say that although I have been politically active all of my life, because of all of the things that have happened this week, mainly the Brown election and the recent Supreme Court decision, I am so discouraged and depressed that I am about ready to tear up my voter registration card and just remove myself from political discourse altogether, because I feel that my vote and my voice won't be heard anymore.
You know, your vote and your voice still count. You made your point this morning on a national public radio program. An awful lot of people hear it. Don't give up. Jackie.
I'm interested in what, in fact, I wouldn't mind getting a response from her, is when she says that it was a combination of the Brown election and the Supreme Court decision on corporate money and politics have made her feel like her vote and voice don't count. There are many, especially on the right, of course, that think that Brown's election in Massachusetts, in fact, pointed out how much their voice and vote do count. So I'd like to know where she's coming from on that.
Even though I'm in Texas, I was very interested in seeing the health care bill get passed, even though the one that the two actually that they're looking at now didn't have everything that I wanted. It was acceptable, and now that I feel because he's there, a lot of things are going to be renegotiated and changed. It's going to be so watered down that it won't be something that will help me or my family at all. So that's one disappointment. I'm just not very hopeful at what they're going to be able to get through, since they had such a hard time getting what little they have through done.
Susan.
You know, it's interesting. What I'm hearing from this caller is that I feel like just about everyone now feels pretty powerless. Voters feel powerless, and they're angry and they want to speak, you know, to take on people in power. So they write emails to those of us in the media thinking we have power, which of course we don't, and to members of Congress. And ironically, members of Congress feel powerless now, too. The Republicans feel powerless because they're so outnumbered by the Democrats. And the Democrats feel powerless because they have huge majorities and still can't get anything done. And then you have the White House feeling like they inherited two wars, an economy verging almost on a depression, and so many other issues. And they've made what they think is in progress, and no one's giving them any credit. So, I mean, join the club in feeling powerless, I guess. But I think, you know, dropping out of the system, I'm not sure what that does.
Neftali.
I mean, I think this sentiment is probably fairly widespread on the left. I think a lot of people feel like, you know, they came in, they have huge majorities. The Democrats just won two overwhelming elections. And what do we have? You know, health care seems to be about to either fall apart or be heavily scaled back. Not much has been accomplished. And I think a real possibility is that in this upcoming election, people like the caller who have been politically active will feel discouraged, dispirited, and will sit out. I think the on the right, there's a feeling of energy, actually. And I think that...
Independence.
Well, that's right. I mean, I think a party has to do two things: energize its base and get independents leaning its way. Right now, both of those things favor the Republicans and disfavor the Democrats.
And do you think if this sentiment continues, you could see a real revolution in both the House and Senate elections?
Well, I think, first of all, it's still 10 months away or whatever.
Sure.
It is, and I think it's early. I think that because of certain factors in the Senate, that's unlikely to change hands. But I think certainly the Democrats are going to lose a reasonable number of seats.
Neftali Ben-David of the Wall Street Journal will talk about how many seats might be lost when we come back. Stay with us.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the Annie E. Casey Foundation, promoting lifelong family connections for children and youth, on the web at aecf.org. By the George Lucas Educational Foundation, creator of Edutopia, your source for what works in public education. Learn more at edutopia.org. And by the Ford Foundation, working with visionaries on the front lines of social change worldwide at FordFoundation.org. This is NPR.
The Friday News Roundup. Rescue and relief efforts continue in Haiti. Defense Secretary Gates offers Pakistan unarmed spy drones. And the rest of the week's top international stories. The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. And here's an email from one of our listeners, Constance in Silver Spring. She says, the American public, the voters, expect too much, too fast, as though the condition of the country were an episode of a TV drama that gets wrapped up in 1 hour. 1 year ago, the country was on the brink of another Great Depression. Other problems had been neglected for years. Is it realistic to expect that everything can be fixed in 12 months? When Obama was inaugurated, I didn't expect him to walk on water. Evidently, a lot of other voters did. and are now so wrapped up in their anger they are blaming Obama for not instantly turning the water of adversity into the wine of prosperity. Somebody raised those expectations. Who was it, Susan?
Well, it might have been the media to some degree during the campaign, and I think also a lot of Obama supporters in 08 sort of saw him as this messianic figure, and I think they also thought they were getting Obama the community organizer, and they got Obama the law professor, which arguably is a better way to run the country. And they forgot that things are different now. You have a very, very determined Republican minority. I've just never seen it so partisan. The idea that you could even have 58 or 59 senators compared to, 41 or 42 and still not be able to get things through because literally, even things that you would not think of as controversial, are filibuster. The Republicans filibuster the defense authorization bill and then voted for it 88 to 12.
Jackie.
Well, there's no question that President Obama himself did more than anyone else to raise expectations by the nature of his campaign rhetoric, and that's natural in a campaign. And he was the change agent. And change from George Bush's policies. But I think the place where he was most raised expectations and it has had ramifications for his entire agenda is the suggestion that he could be a post-partisan president, that everything would be suddenly bipartisan. And while he hadn't been in Washington very long, he had been in the Senate for several years and knew darn well what the dynamic was like there and that it wasn't likely to change overnight, even though he got 53% of the vote.
So a year into his administration, what can he legitimately point to as success? Naftali.
Well, I actually think he's gotten quite a bit done. I think the expectations were exceedingly high, but if you set that aside for a moment, he got a major stimulus bill through, which a lot of economists do credit for helping save the economy.
Most economists.
He got through a budget and an omnibus bill, but he also got through things like a pay equity bill, an expansion of children's health insurance, federal regulation of tobacco, credit card reforms, a public service bill that was pretty bipartisan. So these things keep on passing, and we just kind of shrug our shoulders and move on.
Why do we keep overlooking what he has accomplished?
Well, I do think he bears some responsibility for that. I mean, he's talked about reforming health care as the centerpiece of his domestic agenda. It was held up there as this thing that he was going to achieve where presidents before him had not. So to the extent that that doesn't succeed, I think people see that as a disappointment. And of course, there was all the talk about change and hope in the election, and people were expecting a new era. And so these accomplishments that otherwise might be getting a certain amount of credit, are diminishing.
You know, it's interesting to me that as you talk about this, you don't mention that right at the outset, Republicans said, we're going to kill him.
Right.
We're going to make sure he fails. That, it seems to me, bears as much responsibility for what has not been accomplished as he does, Jackie.
Well, that's exactly right. And what I was going to add when I earlier mentioned that he raised expectations by suggesting he could govern as a postpartisan president. After more than a quarter century in Washington, I've seen a lot of partisanship. And at the same time, I remember back in 1993 when then-Senator Bob Dole was the Republican leader in the Senate, and he announced that President Clinton was not going to get one single Republican vote for his deficit reduction package that year. And that was a big deal. Now it's routine for Senator Mitch McConnell, the Republican leader, on every issue that comes down the pike to say that President Obama is not going to get a single vote. At some point, it's working for them now. At some point, the obstructionism is going to hurt both parties.
I think it already has.
Yeah.
All right, let's go to Lisa in Newton, Massachusetts. You're on the air.
Yes, I have a question about the filibuster and how it got to be used to this extent and what we can do maybe to change it. Do they have to? It seems to me that it would affect not only health care but banking and a lot of kinds of reforms.
There's a lot of talk about changing these rules, Jackie.
Yes, and it's not a recent phenomenon. It's just that it's gotten much worse. I remember my first job in Washington in the mid-'80s was at Congressional Quarterly, a weekly magazine. And I did a cover story one time on the filibuster because it was being used so much, the threat of it, that it had been, the point of the story was that it had been years since the filibuster was really used in the way it was intended, which is if you're opposed to a bill, you take the floor of the Senate and you stand there and talk until you drop. And the other side could just wait for that to happen. What evolved in the post-war years was that, you know, sort of by mutual consent, the parties in the Senate agreed that just the threat of a filibuster might be enough, but it would take a supermajority to vote to shut down that filibuster. It was 67 votes. They liberalized it down to 60 by the 80s, but now it has just become so routine, no matter who's in, whether Democrats are in the minority or Republicans, that in effect, any issue of any controversy in the Senate requires a supermajority of 60 votes, which is not healthy for the
any
democracy.
Any chance of changing that, Neftali?
Well, I think it's probably pretty slim. I mean, a lot of people think it's a bad idea, but it's one of those things that's hard to change. If you're in the majority, you tend to think it's a terrible idea. And if you're in the minority, you think it's a sacred tradition that needs to be preserved. It requires, as I understand it, 67 votes to change the rules in the Senate. In other words, the filibuster is not in the Constitution. It's something that the Senate set up as one of its own rules to protect the right of the minority to debate and so forth. I don't think personally that it was ever envisioned as a 60-vote requirement for any piece of legislation, but changing it, I think, would be very hard.
Susan?
Well, I find it amusing that a lot of the Republicans who are using the filibuster for almost every piece of legislation now are the same ones who are arguing that they should get rid of the filibuster for judicial nominations, when arguably that's the one arena where perhaps a filibuster is most critical, because we're talking about lifetime appointments and so forth. You can understand the frustrations of the—I mean, obviously, look, the whole nature of the Senate is undemocratic in that, you know, Delaware has the same number of senators as California. But you can understand the frustration where if you have, you know, 60 or in this case now 59 votes, but that's actually far more than 59 or 60% of the population when you look at the percentage of the population that those senators represent. And you can certainly understand that frustration.
Now, the other question, one that was raised early on in the healthcare debate, was the use by Democrats of reconciliation as opposed to going for the majority it needed. What about that possibility? Is that now off the table completely?
No. It's definitely one of the things they're still considering. There's basically two ways they can go. They can either amend the Senate bill, try to pass it through the House, and then pass it through the Senate with reconciliation, or they can just scale back dramatically. Those are their two options. I mean, reconciliation, just so we can explain it, it only requires 51 votes for a budget or finance-related
Have they got the 51?
I think they probably have the 51.
All right, let's go to Corey. He's in Akron, Ohio. Good morning to you.
Good morning. I just wanted to say that as a young social liberal, I'm more disappointed that things that could be ended with executive order, like Don't Ask, Don't Tell, are still going. I understand that health care and finance reform is going to take a long time, but things like that could happen right away, and I'm disappointed that they haven't ended yet, and I'll take my comments off the air.
Susan?
Well, I think on Don't Ask, Don't Tell, a lot of people share your frustration over that, but what I find interesting is that President Obama is facing some of the same issues in his first year and change as President Clinton did, and it's arguable that it was a mistake that President Clinton took on the gays and the military issues so early, not because he was wrong on the issue, but because it was so divisive and it weakened him for other issues. And I think that's one of the reasons that the White House has put that aside. They wanted to put other political capital into things like health care first. But he did do other things. I mean, the stem cell, the stem cell issue he followed through on.
All right. To Kalamazoo, Michigan. Good morning, Mike. You're on the air.
Hi, everybody. I was going to comment earlier on, the way the president is being judged, you know, in the environment that he's come in on his first year, you know, come on, depression, practically depression and two wars that were handed to him. And I'm glad you guys, you know, followed through with that and talked about that some more afterwards. That woman who called in the email was very eloquent about that. And so moving on, I would like to just comment on the reconciliation. I'm all for it. You know, the Republicans are so happy these days. They've had this great week for them. Excuse me, my heart's racing right now because I'm a big liberal.
Slow down. You're fine.
For us here, you know?
Yeah.
But, you know, I urge Americans to be patient. It takes time to make things happen with this Congress and these rules, and I hope the American people will pay more attention to, you know, how the Republicans have been playing their game for the past 20 years. And, you know, Democrats get in, they fix government, people get a little PO'd about it and pay more taxes, so we'll get the Republicans back in, and they break it again. And I'd like to see the American people smarten up, be patient, and follow through with something for once.
Interesting comments. Jackie?
You know, the element of patience, it's interesting. Actually, the recent Wall Street Journal NBC poll showed that 67% of Americans say that President Obama, you know, agree that he inherited big problems and they don't expect them to be solved quickly. And just 15% disagree with that, which suggests a pretty overwhelming sense of patience in the country. But what you have in these elections, in these off special election in Massachusetts, off-year elections last year in New Jersey and Virginia, is very low turnout, and the people who come out are motivated, and usually the best motivator in politics is anger and opposition. So it tends to bring out, you know, the other side. And so we can overinterpret results, although, you know, I wouldn't want to suggest that there isn't a big message here for Democrats.
No tally.
I think what the caller was saying is a lot of what the Democrats were telling each other on Capitol Hill this week. There was a lot of talk about taking a deep breath, about pausing, about not rushing forward. Let's see what all this means. And so I think some of the message that the caller was expressing is some of what Democrats have taken from the Massachusetts race. Okay, something happened here, but let's take a deep breath. Let's figure out the best way forward, and let's not overreact to what just happened.
Neftali Ben-David, The Wall Street Journal. You're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. And on that Massachusetts election, let's go to Kameen in Indianapolis. Good morning to you.
Hello. I just wanted to ask the question about how much impact the progressives had in the Massachusetts race, and at least how the Obama administration now looks at the left after that, because Rahm Emanuel was caught saying that they should ignore the left when they started off this administration. And I wonder now if the Massachusetts election has changed that perspective.
Susan?
I don't recall hearing Rahm saying that, or at least not publicly. But I do think that, I don't have a sense from any of the polling. I don't know anybody who did any exit polling in Massachusetts of how many progressives showed up, but they were certainly having a problem getting them motivated. They were not excited about Martha Coakley. They were distraught over things that were happening in Washington. They wanted a single payer system or a public option. Some people forget that, actually, when they talk about the health care plan and the opposition to it, that some people oppose it because they think it's just too watered down. And definitely they kind of realized very late that they were going to have to motivate that element of the party in Massachusetts if Coakley was going to pull out a win. And they may have gotten in there too late. But I don't have a sense of how many people actually showed up at the polls
all
from
right.
that segment.
To Eldridge, New York. Good morning, Marcia.
Hi, Diane. I have a question about the executive branch, the judicial branch, and the House branch. I understand that our Constitution was written with built-in checks and balances in mind between the three branches of government, and I get how the House branch keeps the executive branch in line and the judicial branch keeps the House branch in line, but given the recent, or just yesterday, decision that the Supreme Court handed down, I'm wondering if anybody keeps them in line. You know, the Supreme Court isn't supposed to have an agenda, and yet this decision clearly displays that they do.
Well, this is an issue that comes up periodically. It certainly came up after the Bush v. Gore decision, and then, of course, very much during the 60s with the Earl Warren Court. There's always this fear that the Supreme Court has too much power and there's nobody who can really cut it back. You know, the options are pretty limited. I guess you can impeach Supreme Court justices, but the fact is that they have quite a bit of power should they choose to exercise it.
All right, and I've asked each one of you to think about a brief statement you might want to include in the President's State of the Union address next week, Naftali?
Well, I think maybe he should say something like, I'm the first to admit that this first year has not been everything that I'd hoped, but we remain a passionate and optimistic country, and together we can recapture the unity and hope that brought us to Washington a year ago.
Susan.
I think you should say to Congress, I think you should all remember that this institution is bigger than any one of your egos or either one of your parties.
And you'd stop there. How about you?
Get mixed up.
Jackie.
I have to admit to a little discomfort at trying to suggest I'm advising the president what he would say. But, I mean, I think he should take the opportunity to remind people how far, you know, to toot his own horn and remind people how far he's come or we've come.
Do you think he hasn't done that enough?
I think he's constrained in how much. I think he hasn't done it enough, but he's also constrained by the fact that people with 10% plus unemployment, people don't want to hear that it's good. They aren't feeling good.
Jackie Combs of New York Times, Naftali Ben-David at the Wall Street Journal, Susan Milligan of the Boston Globe. Thank you all. I'll be off for a few days next week. I'm going off for a voice treatment. I hope to be back with you about the middle of the week. I'll look forward to hearing from you again. Thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, and Monique Nazareth. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR.